This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with a race for governor. Three debates, third-party attack ads, and a fight between Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Charlie Baker over child welfare.
Your administration was cutting caseloads and cutting budgets. We were seeing the uptick in those caseloads in the child abuse unit where I work.
We should move to fix what's wrong at the agency, not to pursue a litigation strategy.
Plus, a new study from the ACLU raises difficult questions about policing in high-crime neighborhoods and racial bias in Boston.
Two neighborhoods that are otherwise identical in terms of crime, the neighborhood with the higher percentage of black people is going to be targeted for more police encounters.
And Boston city councilors keep up with the high cost of living by giving themselves a pay raise, as Mayor Marty Walsh weighs a possible veto.
And I'll make a decision next few days.
We'll dive into all of that and more, including our weekly hubbubs. Joining us now, David Scharfenberg. He's politics and public policy reporter for the Boston Globe. Good to have you, David.
Thank you, sir.
Also with us is Mike Ross. He's a Boston attorney and former Boston City Councilor. Great to have you back, Mike.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's start with the governor's race, which is very close, according to the latest polls. A poll from WBUR gives Attorney General Martha Coakley a 2-point edge over Charlie Baker, whereas the Boston Globe shows a 5-point lead for Martha Coakley, which was a reversal from last week when they had Baker up by 3 points. Now, as the race tightens, the tone, of course, is getting tougher between the two main party candidates. And this week, the fight was over child welfare, as we mentioned. Charlie Baker criticized Coakley for defending the Department of Children and Families against a lawsuit that accused the agency of endangering foster children.
Commonwealth would have been better served, and the people would have been better served by that agency if, instead of litigating that case, Massachusetts, like 15 other states, had moved forward with a plan to fix what was broken.
But Martha Coakley stood by her decision to defend the agency against the lawsuit.
Say it would be better to spend that money on lawyers outside to get a one-size-fits-all that most people agree was not right for Massachusetts. To me, that's not a good manager's decision.
All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about that and Martha Coakley's return attack against Charlie Baker in just a second. But David, let's just first start with you. What do you make of the very punchy and critical tone the race has taken over the past week?
Well, it certainly has gotten sharper here as we get closer and closer to Election Day, just about 4 weeks away now. I think this whole back and forth speaks to, in part, kind of the double-edged sword for Martha Coakley as Attorney General. I mean, in some sense, she gets to be in the headlines quite a bit, make some news, set the agenda to some degree, but these sorts of kind of tricky issues are going to come back to bite her as well, and we've seen that here. Then again, she was able to fight back, be a bit punchier than she often is on the campaign trail, and that may have actually hurt Baker some. There's some evidence, given that in our poll, as you mentioned, she has kind of shot up by about 8 points over the course of a couple weeks, that there may be some backlash to the attacks on her and her handling of that suit. She, of course, has a long history of working on child abuse cases and such, and actually considers that a strength of hers.
Hmm. And Mike, I mean, do you think these back and forths over child welfare are going to play with voters come November? I mean, we're just, what, three-ish weeks away from that. Are these attacks effective over the long haul?
Well, I mean, in a race this close, I think they very well could be. I think the other side of this double-edged sword that David referred to, that Martha has to deal with, that the Attorney General has to deal with, that Charlie Baker does not, is Deval Patrick is fair game for Charlie Baker. So any mistake that's been made by the administration can be heaped at Martha. And Martha Coakley will, she really can't overly criticize Deval Patrick. He's got the highest approval rating within the party out of anyone in Massachusetts. You obviously wouldn't go against your own, governor. So I see, she has to deal with that. Charlie Baker doesn't. So him kind of hurling these, and there's enough out there, there's enough things that I think happened in the last 8 years that he can just kind of attack the party and attack Martha Coakley.
Right. So, David, that actually makes me wonder. I mean, this round of discussion or debate over DCF really came about because of a super PAC ad, a third-party ad criticizing Martha Coakley. Earlier this week, we also heard that former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, not only has he endorsed Charlie Baker, but he's also promised to spend $25 million in 10 races nationwide through his super PAC, some of which would go to Charlie Baker. So we are seeing outside money sort of flexing its muscle in this race. How much do you think that matters? Would we even be talking about DCF if it weren't for those ads?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's funny. The state has been a little behind the curve here in terms of the arrival of outside money. We, of course, had Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown agree to their People's Pledge a couple of years back. There have been a couple of imitators since then. So it's really with this governor's race that we see for the first time super PACs playing a big role in a statewide race. And one of the advantages of super PACs is, in theory, they can go negative. They can hit hard and perhaps insulate the candidate they're supporting from the backlash. I think there's a real question, though, as to whether the average voter really delineates between a super PAC attack ad and that of a candidate. So again, it's possible that Charlie Baker, even though he did not launch this particular ad, could feel the anger of voters if they're not pleased with it.
It's interesting, you know, David, just sticking with this point about the super PACs, I was thinking about this today, and I'm just wondering, you know, as I look at this race and try to figure out how the voters are trying to figure it out, I'm sort of wondering if the super PAC ads actually help or instead really cloud the issue. Because when I try to sort out this argument between Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley over their records on DCF and taking care of children and the caseloads, it just seems like the super PAC ads are just sort of confusing the issue, clouding the issue, and not helping voters really, really sort it out. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they are certainly going for pithy and negative sound bites. And you know, listen, we've seen distortion, plenty of distortion by candidates in campaigns as well. I think you're just seeing it energized here, supersized, if you will, with all the outside money coming in. And again, perhaps these super PACs feeling like they can take it even a step, you know, a little step further than the candidates themselves. You know, this is a tricky issue. I mean, Martha Coakley's people will say, look, I'm the state's lawyer. I've got to defend this agency. And Charlie Baker will come back and say, yeah, but, you know, perhaps you could have been a little more proactive in actually reforming the place. So, you know, there's a mix of kind of cheap shots and substance here, and it's going to be up to the voters to pick those apart.
Well, let's just hear for a moment a criticism that Martha Coakley is heaping on Charlie Baker. This, of course, is not about DCF, but about how much Charlie Baker earned as CEO when he was with Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. Martha Coakley has been saying that Baker basically outsourced mental health care and raised premiums while he was there, but he also gave himself a raise. So let's listen.
While he was doing that as head of a not-for-profit, he went from a $600,000 salary to a $1.7 million salary. He's entitled to do that. I'm just saying voters should know where his priorities lie and what his decision-making pulls in the balance when he makes those.
So, Mike, just brief thoughts from you about this. I mean, we were talking about the heavy issue of children and DCF when Baker is criticizing Coakley, but here we have the issue of healthcare and a CEO's salary. I mean, do you think it has sort of the same pull as the DCF criticism does of Martha Coakley?
Yeah, I mean, the DCF thing was complicated,
yeah.
And who was at fault was also complicated. But someone, what they get paid and the cost of healthcare is very uncomplicated. The average worker out there, just hearing that line over, say, comparing that with some criticism on DCF, It's apples and oranges, and I think that that line hurts, and in some way, I think that line hurts more than the other line, even though it was a more serious set of and more complicated set of circumstances.
Hmm.
The average worker hearing that, you know, not only are your bills raising in cost, but the people who run those companies are earning over, you know, $1.7 million. They're going to remember that.
Mm. Well, let's talk about a new report that's prompting some new questions about police procedures in Boston and whether they're unfairly targeting black residents. The analysis was done by two independent researchers in the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, and they reviewed more than 200,000 reports filed between 2007 and 2010 by police after they stopped, questioned, searched, or simply observed someone. And what they found was that more than 60% of those encounters were with African Americans. This in a city where blacks make up about a quarter of the population. So here's Carl Williams, who appeared on Radio Boston earlier this week. He's an attorney with the ACLU of Massachusetts.
Some might say, well, that's where the crime is. The police are going where the crime is.
Mm-hmm.
However, even controlling for crime, and adding into that mix, controlling for gang membership and alleged gang membership. Even when you take those factors into consideration, black people are being stopped more.
So that sounds troubling. We heard some pushback, though. Here's the Reverend Mark Scott of the Azusa Christian Community Church in Dorchester. He works with at-risk youth and says this report draws the wrong conclusion about what's actually happening.
The police are not systematically stopping black men because they're black. They have a limited amount of resources. And the folks, the leaders, the residents, the citizens, the taxpayers in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan demand strong policing. So I would expect to see more stops in those communities.
Michael Ross, I'd like to come to you first. I mean, we heard Reverend Scott there. He also, by the way, praised the relationship between the police and these neighborhoods. He said over the years things have gotten a lot better. On the other hand, there are those statistics. What do you think? What's going on here? How do you read this?
Well, first, no major urban center in America is not free and clear of this issue. Latent, unconscious, subconscious forms of racism exist institutionally. And this has been proven by social scientists. I mean, this is just, these are innate, historical, you know, remnants that echo in society, and it's a complex set of issues. And they manifest in cities, and they manifest with police departments. That being said, this particular police department here in Boston, which recently, under Mayor Walsh's leadership, hired Willie Gross to be the chief of the police department, an African-American male, is an in-touch, connected police department. The guy who runs it, Commissioner Evans, is the same person who was, I think, the example for Occupy Wall Street across the country. When you had, you know, riots across the country, he was in charge of that here in Boston. He did an amazing job.
He got a lot of plaudits for what he did, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can't directly compare how you handle Occupy Boston versus the relationship between African-Americans and the police department. But it goes to, I think, the set of, you know, skills you need to be tolerant and to be open and be understanding. And clearly those are skill sets that Bill Evans possess.
David, I'd love to get your take on this because, you know, when I was listening to those two points of view there, one from Carl Williams and one from Reverend Mark Scott, it seems like maybe they were talking about sort of two different things. I mean, on the one hand, you've got folks saying this isn't the Boston of long ago. There isn't rampant racism or dramatic evidence of racial profiling. On the other hand, the statistics suggest there's always room for improvement, and there probably is still room for improvement. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's been a really kind of interesting tension between data and relationships. Marty Walsh, when he was running for mayor, did a really good job of kind of courting the black and Latino communities in this city. He had some real success there, and I think he's built some real trust there. On the other hand, he's struggled to build an administration as diverse as he'd like it to be, but I think some of the leaders in those communities have said, you know, we trust that this guy's heart's in the right place and that he's trying. And I think that's what you're seeing play out here with these police statistics. Again, these numbers predate the Walsh administration, but I think a lot of community leaders think this guy is trying. He's trying to build a better relationship, and yet those numbers are there. And I think the administration says they need to be worked upon. So it's just an interesting tension. We're going to watch it play out, I think, for years on end here.
I think it's also worth pointing out that these numbers predate the Walsh here. In fact, let's listen to what Marty Walsh said about this. He says that a lot has changed in the department, and points out that these statistics were referring to a time between 2007 and 2010.
Very different time and very different city. We've made a lot of changes in the police department. You know, with the command staff, we're really focusing differently in the neighborhoods to bring crime down, and violent crime down. The numbers are down. With the lowering of violent crime in communities, hopefully you'd see the numbers change drastically.
Mike Ross, that sort of gets to the point you were speaking to, but I'd even say, you know, we've seen a change in the Boston Police Department through, you know, I don't know, two or three administrations. I mean, things have been improving steadily over time.
Yeah, unquestionably. It's closer to the people they serve, the police department. It still has a way to go. It still has, you know, diversity issues, and it doesn't reflect the city as a whole, but it's heading in that direction. Also, crime is down. It's getting much harder. These 20, 30, 40 percent drops in crime, it's hard to do when you start to get to a very, very low number. And yet, again, this year, the crime has gone down.
Well, let's move on if we can and talk about one more issue that was the talk of Boston this week, and that is not only the high cost of living and what to do about it, but the Boston City Council seems to have an answer for itself. They have voted themselves a pay raise. In a vote from 9-4, they're going to increase their salaries beginning in 2016 by roughly 23%. And so in that beginning that year, the city councilor will earn $107,000 a year. Now, Mayor Marty Walsh is considering whether or to veto the pay hike, but it appears that the council does, at this point in time, have the two-thirds majority to override that veto. So Mike Ross, as a former city councilor, let me first start with you. I mean, what do you make of the fact that the council has voted itself this 23% pay raise?
Well, as a former city councilor, I clearly left the city council too
soon. Early.
Yeah, that my first thought. I think I'm not so sure that the city council has the authority to override the mayor's veto on a budgetary item. It's something that the Corporation Council and also Sam Tyler from the Municipal Research Bureau has raised, and the council cannot initiate operating expenses, without the mayor's approval. So this calls that into question.
Do you think the overall raise is warranted, though?
Yeah, on the pure kind of look of it, it doesn't look right. It appears to be in some ways an arbitrary number, and in some ways too big of a number.
Oh, interesting. But
I think handling the raise issue is always going to draw criticism. So the real question was kind of what Ayanna Pressley and Matt O'Malley were working on is, what set of formulas can we create that we take this off the table, that the raise is tied to an index, or that it goes up a certain number, or, and we take ourselves out of this?
Yeah.
I think that might have been the way to go.
You know, David, I'm interested to hear what Mike has to say, having been a city councilor, because the council hasn't received a pay raise since 2006. And, I went back and actually did some inflation calculation just to see what the value of a dollar has changed in the roughly 9-year period we're talking about. And the cumulative rate of inflation, I'm looking at CPI numbers here, is 21.8%, 22% roughly. And this pay raise is 23%. So, just based on that one measure alone, which may not be an adequate one, it doesn't seem like a terribly, overly generous pay raise, but I know the optics are still pretty bad on this.
Right. I mean, this is sort of all about symbolism. I mean, but as you said, the number itself isn't so bad. We had another calculation done here at the Globe, which showed with the raise, these councilors would actually be paid less per resident than they were 5 years ago. That has something to do with the growing population of the city of Boston. But again, it doesn't look great, and I think Mike brings up a good point. It's taking it out of their hands might be the way to do it. The state legislature, for instance, has tied its salary hikes to the state's median income. So all of a sudden, you kind of get identified with the average Massachusetts resident, and you don't have to vote on this on a regular or semi-regular basis. That might be the way out of this. But until then, the mayor's got to decide if he's going to veto the pay hikes for a council that he has vowed to form a closer relationship with versus his predecessor, Tom Menino. So that'll be interesting to watch.
All right. Well, that gives us enough time to move on to our hubbubs, those stories that didn't sort of make it on the front pages of the papers this week. Mike Ross, let me come to you first. Your hubbub.
Well, it truly is a new day in Boston. Last week, Saturday night, after Yom Kippur, right? So followed a day of fasting for the Jewish community. At night, there was a massive food truck festival post midnight on Dewey Square.
Wow.
On the Rose Canyon Greenway. There were multiple trucks. It was put on by the Mass Department of Transportation, and until 1:30 in the morning. Really, for the first time, I think in Boston's history, you could come out and really do this like post-midnight event. And it signals to me, and full disclosure, I worked on that in a legal capacity. But on the political side, it signals to me that there really is a change coming out of City Hall, that there really is an interest to extend the night. Of course, pushed by the MBTA late night service. And, It was fun. I went out there, and I have to tell you, I was getting tired because I don't stay out that late anymore. But I went out there to check it out, and it was a great scene. There were a lot of people enjoying it, you know, people in their 20s and 30s, maybe a little more, people like me, maybe in their, you know, young 40s. And it was great. And, you know, I bought some food, and there was some fashion trucks and art trucks there. I bought a little piece of art, and I had a great time.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Changing city. David, how about you? Your hubbub.
Well, mine's a bit downbeat, I'm afraid. A year and a half after the Boston Phoenix closed down, the publisher announced just yesterday that he is shutting down the Providence Phoenix, my former employer south of the border in Rhode Island. So it's a sad day down there. Another former employer of mine, the Providence Journal, has also seen some staff laid off lately as new ownership comes in. And you're seeing kind of a hollowing out of journalism down there in what is an important New England city. And so that's sad. I think the upside here up in Boston is that we still have a pretty robust local media, you know, we should be grateful for that.
And only the Portland Phoenix is left, right, David?
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, here's my hubbub. This is an indication of just what's going on up in New Hampshire, where incumbent Democratic Senator Gene Shaheen is facing a challenge from Scott Brown. Obviously, hugely important race. All kinds of money pouring into that race. And here are some numbers from the Center for Public Integrity. More than 10,000 television ads have aired so far in that race, 10,300 to be precise. Of all the TV stations in the country, no single station aired more ads in the U.S. Senate races than WMUR-TV in New Hampshire. And so the people at the Hearst Corporation, obviously, which owns WMUR, must be loving this right now because revenues are obviously pouring into that station. But here's the way the numbers break down. Roughly $6 million total have been spent. And how do you think it breaks down between Shaheen and the Democrats and Brown and the Republicans? Roughly, here we are, $3 million for Jean Shaheen and her Democratic allies, $2.7 million so far for Scott Brown and his Republicans. So approaching $6 million on advertising in that one Senate race.
10,000 ads.
10,300 ads and counting.
It's amazing. Okay, I just want to point out that all three of you brought up very important stories for our hubbub this week. I am going to bring up a story that's important to the internet.
Thank God.
Okay, so over the weekend, all the rage on Twitter and Reddit was about something that actually happened right here in Boston when WBZ meteorologist Barry Burbank held his coffee cup upside down on live television. How dare he? There was nothing in the cup. It was upside down. Was it a faux pas? What was it? I don't know. The internet seemed to care a lot about this. So much so that it went viral. It was trending all over, especially on Reddit. People had theories. I'm sure there were conspiracy theories given that it was Reddit. So Burbank explained why he had held his coffee cup upside down a little earlier this week.
So I thought, well, now let's see. Let's go on the air, and I'll have my cup turned upside down and maybe see if people notice that the cup is upside down.
Oh, they notice.
And they always say that my cup is always empty, not just half full or half empty. It's always empty. So there you go. Cheers.
Okay, so Barry Burbank getting a little metaphysical there. I guess Barry is at him saying that he's pessimistic all the time. I don't know. But this became such huge news, really. This became such huge news that even Jimmy Fallon mentioned it on his monologue on Monday night.
Look at that guy's coffee mug again. I mean, this... The only way you could save that is like, mugs, are they safer held upside down? A new report finds the answer.
Okay, Jimmy Fallon on Barry Burbank's coffee mug. It was important to the internet, and that is why is my hubbub.
Right. Well, Mike Ross, his coffee cup is always right side up. He's an attorney and former Boston City Councilor. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it. And David Scharfenberg, politics and public policy reporter for the Boston Globe. David, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk to Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Steve Kerrigan. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.